Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Well, hello there, Buzzkillers. It's your favorite professor here, and I'm here, of course, with my favorite professor, Professor Philip Nash. How are you, Professor?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
We're getting so many compliments about your shows and your episodes on Facebook, on Twitter, on the Instagram, and all the other internet things. People keep asking me, you know, why doesn't he have his own podcast? Why don't you have your own podcast, Professor?
I would have no idea how to go about that.
Well, it's expensive and time-consuming. But, of course, this is Professor Buzzkill. We bust myths. We take names. We're gluten-free and data-driven. We're here to talk about the famous Rommel myth. We've touched on General Rommel, Erwin Rommel, in different episodes, and episodes on Hitler and episodes on World War II. But, of course, we haven't explored what is actually known, what is actually codified, what's actually searchable as the on Google, as the Rommel myth, right, Professor? I mean, it's amazing that people have actually identified this myth so clearly.
Right. He has his own myth. And, you know, myth or no myth, he's an important figure in World War II.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we've done Patton, we've done MacArthur. I mean, he certainly deserves his own show.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, movies. We have at least several books and at least two movies, mm-hmm. as far as we know. And we have a major man crush on James Mason here in the bunker. When it gets lonely, we start thinking of James Mason.
That big poster we have up in the bunker.
That's right. And so why not? You know, it's an important thing for historians and for us when we're teaching our classes, and we think it's important for the Buzzkillers.
That's right.
But listen, let's, of course, as we always do, let's set the context. Who was he? Where was he born? Well, all that sort of stuff, all that background that we'll need to understand his later life.
Who is Erwin Rommel? He was born in 1891, just about 2 years after Adolf Hitler. He's from Württemberg, which is in southwestern Germany.
Uh-huh.
He was, as a young man, he was a military cadet. I would urge people to look into it. I'm not going to go into it, but I would urge people to look at his World War I career because it really was very impressive. He was a junior officer. He was a company commander. He was commander of a mountain battalion at a time when that was a relatively new thing. Hmm. And his performance is extremely impressive, especially in Italy during the Caporetto Offensive of 1917, where his unit basically just went on this amazing tear where they drove, and keep in mind, this is during World War I when even small advances are very impressive. His unit
and things were a lot slower.
Yes, things were a lot slower, like, right? And it's not mechanized, it's all on foot. But his unit, which I believe was a battalion, a company. So it was about 100, 150 guys. They broke through and just sort of kept going and bagged hundreds of Italian prisoners and drove deep behind enemy lines. And his performance was so impressive, he was awarded the coveted Pour le Mérite, if I'm pronouncing that.
Oh, right.
That's the Blue Max. In fact, there's a movie called The Blue Max.
Yes, that's
the most coveted of the German German medals. Even though it has got a French name, yeah. Which I always thought was odd.
We're all about the 50s and 60s World War II movies in the bunker here.
Yes,
which reminds me, we should remind the Buzzkillers that because when you hear Germany attacking Italy, most people think of Italy being an ally of Germany, but in World War I, they weren't.
That's right. On
the other side.
That's right. So German forces were sent to bolster the Austro-Hungarians in the Alps.
Right.
And so
against
the Italians. So he did really, really well there.
Is this where the famous lead from the front sort of story about him comes
about? Yes. I mean, yeah, he certainly establishes that pattern very early in his career. And we've talked about this, I think, in other shows, like with Patton, for example. Especially in World War I, World War II, the most effective commanders, sort of battlefield commanders, are often those who so-called lead from the front.
Mm-hmm. Meaning he's out there.
You know, and there's a fine line between doing that and micromanaging. There's a fine line between doing that and taking unnecessary risks with your own life, right? You know, your unit doesn't benefit if you get wounded or killed. And he was wounded, I believe, in World War I.
And putting your staff at risk.
Perhaps
unnecessarily, right?
Right. But, I mean, if you're good at what you do and you sort of take a hands-on approach, that can give you a huge advantage over the enemy. And you see that in Rommel's early career.
Okay, now he's not necessarily a pioneer of the lead from the front.
No, absolutely not. No. You see that in war as well before this.
Sure, okay.
Certainly. But he's definitely a practitioner of it.
We should tell the Buzzkillers that in our notes and our outline that you very kindly made up for us, you have him listed as a badass. I think that's an official Buzzkill Bunker designation.
Exactly. I've forgotten what the German term is, but in the reports. But yes, I would call, if you look at his World War I performance, he deserves the appellation badass.
That's good.
So then he pursues his career in the interwar period. He joins the very tiny Reichswehr of the interwar period. Buzzkiller should know that the German military was extremely small under the terms of the Versailles Treaty.
Right.
After World War I. But he remains sort of a career military junior to mid-level officer. He meets Adolf Hitler fairly early on in the Nazi years, 1934. It's just a sort of a chance meeting. He's head of an honor guard for Hitler in 1934 at one point. But after that, a few years later, he slowly... gets noticed in sort of, not in Hitler's inner circle, but he has more and more contact with Hitler. For example, he is assigned to Hitler's personal protection detail in 1936. At this point, he's a lieutenant colonel.
Oh, that's pretty early on. So yeah, he really does know him for a long time.
Yeah, he really does. And I don't know for sure, but I think there's some people later on who sort of imply that he met him later. Mm-hmm. You know, try to maybe make him look a little bit better. But he certainly knows him early on. Also in this relatively early period, he is a liaison between the army, the German army, and the Hitler Youth.
Oh.
Which I thought was interesting, because I think that often gets overlooked as well. That's the kind of thing you don't want to play up if you're trying to sort of denazify Rommel.
Which we'll talk about later when we talk about the people who interpreted him. And of course, he's only 40-something, right?
Right.
Early 40s by the time of that Hitler Youth thing.
And he publishes a book called Infantry Attacks, which is about his World War I experience, which was probably read by Adolf Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, will help him get noticed. 1938, he becomes the commanding officer of Hitler's personal escort battalion. And here's where they really start to get to know each other pretty well. They spend a lot of time together, spend a lot of time talking, and clearly there is a mutual affinity. There's all sorts of evidence in Rommel's letters that he is an admirer of Adolf Hitler.
Oh, okay. So this is early on, before the war even really starts.
That's right. It's pretty clear that he thinks Hitler is sort of the man Germany needs. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that Rommel's a Nazi, and we can talk about this later, but he clearly admires Hitler as sort of a bold and strong and a magnetic leader.
Okay.
And he says lots of flattering things about him in his letters home. They also agree on the direction of the military buildup that Germany is undertaking in the late 30s. And that kind of sets Rommel apart from a lot of the other generals, some of whom are still sort of World War I thinkers.
Right.
Both Hitler and Rommel agree about the sort of the future of Blitzkrieg, that you need the most modern possible armored units working in tandem with aircraft units. And so that helps sort of solidify the bond between the two.
But correct me if I'm overstating the case here, that we could characterize this as kind of, if we want to overblow it, a rendezvous with destiny. These two guys come together. You've got Rommel, who's a leading from the front guy, who's pushing this idea of aggressive military infantry attacks in his book and all things. And Hitler is an aggressive politician.
Right.
So is it, are these two bound to have found each other?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about that. I mean, for example, it's possible to imagine a future where Rommel remains sort of as, in command of Hitler's escort battalion isn't really given a combat command. Yeah, so I'm in general hesitant to ever talk about rendezvous with destiny, but
but we love those here.
Yeah, I know they're very attractive sometimes.
But he's certainly not a late convert to Nazism because he has to be because the war's already started.
No. And that's part of the myth. After World War II, you see a lot of people who basically say he's not a supporter of Nazism. That's just not him. And you really can't say that. It goes too far to say he's a Nazi, but he's not an anti-Nazi at all. And lots of reason to think that he is a true admirer of Hitler and is sort of, down with the program, essentially.
Sure.
Certainly of expansion.
And we should, of course, remind the Buzzkillers, as we've said in your wonderful Hitler episodes, there were opponents of Hitler. It's not as
right.
Even though he was elected chancellor and on and on and on.
And high up in the German military.
Yeah.
And they had to be purged.
Yeah. So it's not as if he would be, a lone wolf in the wilderness crying out against the mustached one. But, he wasn't.
Right. No. In fact, in that same year, 1938, Hitler purges his top military generals. And it's because they're not on board. They're not supportive enough for his tastes. So in 1939, which is the year the war starts, he is promoted to major general. So he has risen pretty quickly and rises even more quickly after he starts spending a lot of time with Hitler. Mm-hmm. And it's clear that Hitler sort of likes him enough and sort of paves the way for his further rise. So by 1939, he's promoted to major general, and he's made the commanding officer of the Führer's headquarters. The army unit that sort of surrounds the Führer's headquarters.
So he's really a political military leader as well as a
well, yes, yeah, certainly politically connected.
Better, yeah.
Absolutely. He does not actually take part in the Polish campaign because he's the commander of the Führer's headquarters.
This is 39.
It was 1939. But in 1940, during the attack on the West, that's where he really gets his modern reputation as a panzer commander, as a tank general in the field doing amazing things. So he for the big attack in the West in May 1940 against Holland and Belgium and France,
right.
He is put in command of the 7th Panzer Division. Remember, there are, I forget how many panzer divisions there are. It's maybe a dozen at most. And these are the really coveted slots, right? This is the big attack against France and Britain. There aren't that many panzer divisions. He is catapulted way above a bunch of more senior commanders. And this is where you start to see, and it's going to only build in many, many different ways over the coming years, but this is where you start to see resentment of him.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes, among other generals. You know, that happens in all armies. It certainly happens in the American army, where someone like Eisenhower is catapulted above, I don't know, 100 or 200 more senior people who figure it's their turn.
Right.
This is a similar dynamic. He's given the official personnel office of the German Wehrmacht said that Rommel should command a mountain division, partly because of his experience in World War I.
Right.
It's logical. He doesn't have much experience with tanks.
Oh, that's interesting, because that's his big
certainly. You know, he was up on armored warfare, and we can talk about that later, but he had never actually done this, right? For example, you'd think you might want to have him command a panzer regiment or a panzer battalion first and then give him a panzer division. But this is Hitler sort of overruling the personnel office and saying, no, I want him to command 7th Panzer Division, which was in a way kind of not just any panzer division. In that offensive, it was sort of the point of the spear.
Oh, no. Okay. Again, leading from the front.
From the front, and also just playing this unit in particular is playing a key role in the attack. Anyway, so his unit makes it through we talked about this before, the quote-unquote impenetrable Ardennes Forest, where the French army was extremely weak, and he manages to get through the forest in 3 days and then crosses the Meuse River, which was the only real physical obstacle at that point. And this is classic leading from the front. This is a contested river crossing a river under fire is extremely difficult to do.
Oh, sure, yeah.
As you might imagine. And he's there, and I've read accounts of this. He's very much hands-on, working the problem, doing things like ordering a house to be set on fire to provide smoke so that his troops can cross. I mean, he does that sort of clever move. Anyway, so he gets his unit across the river in 3 days. This is the World War II timetable. The French basically don't know what hit them.
Right, right.
And after that, it's the race to the Channel, led by his so-called Ghost Division. That's what the 7th Panzer Division was known as afterwards.
Because I've always wondered, is it because that was so fast people couldn't keep up where it was? Or
right,
they were just
that's part of it. Yeah, and okay. Once the Germans break through in the center in this campaign, it's extremely fluid, and it's almost impossible for the British and French to reform a front line.
Okay.
So, yeah, and so, and Rommel in particular is driving his troops so hard, they seem to be everywhere and nowhere. And, you know, by the time you get an intelligence report back at headquarters, it's out of date because they've already moved on, that kind of thing.
Okay. Is he doing anything to sort of promote these ideas of the, I mean, apart from obviously the military work, is he like any public relations arm to his thing?
Yes, he is. And here's where you start to see what I will call his self-promotion.
Oh, okay.
He's kind of a publicity hound.
Wow.
And he loves to be photographed. If he were a general today, he'd be taking constant selfies in front of like destroyed French tanks.
Rommel selfies.
Exactly. Here's me with this tank I just knocked out. That kind of thing. But he writes a history of his division in combat, which apparently is embellished.
Uh-huh.
And I was blown away by this. A few months later, he actually directs the reenactment of one of his subsequent river crossings. This is so postmodern. This is really? So meta. Yeah, he's actually directing the part of a film because they make a film. The Germans make a propaganda film about their campaign in France that comes out in 1941. It's called Victory in the West. And Rommel actually has a hand in directing a reenactment, which I guess makes sense from one standpoint because he was there and knew what went down. But the whole idea that you're like,
yeah,
Erwin Rommel, this is your life, that kind of thing. It's like
the director could have just read the book,
right? Or and anyone back on the home front is going to say, wait, that's not accurate.
Yeah, that's
right. I mean, it's really kind of odd. But and he's obviously big in this. He loves the idea that he's playing a role in shaping his own reputation after the fact.
Wow. Wow.
And that's also going to help cause some resentment among some of his colleagues in the military and in the Nazi party, because he's really big on sort of burnishing his image. Mm-hmm. Loved being photographed. Apparently he didn't wear glasses even though he needed them.
Oh,
and
okay.
People used to badmouth him about that, like how vain he is.
Yeah. Well, if you're leading from the front, you're not seeing well then.
Exactly. My glasses keep fogging up. Yeah. But he's not unique in this age. You have a lot of people who stumble around through life because they refuse to be seen in eyeglasses.
Well, and a lot of tank commanders, Patton, who are interested in self-promotion and who believe, and maybe Rommel does too, that it keeps the men happy. It keeps the men
Yes. Yeah. Now I don't know that about his case, but he clearly has an ego. He's clearly very pleased with his image and very happy to play a role in shaping it.
Oh, okay.
No question. Then comes his big assignment. In early 1941, he is assigned to lead the Deutsche Afrika Corps, the Afrika Corps, to bail out Mussolini, who's gotten into trouble with the British.
In North Africa.
Keep in mind that the British possession, Egypt, is right next to the Italian possession, Libya. Mm-hmm. The Libyans attack Egypt in fall of 1940, and then the British counterattack. And it's actually one of the most successful British campaigns of the entire war, Operation Compass, late 40, early 41. They, 30,000 British troops capture 130,000 Italians.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a pretty impressive campaign, and the British conquer essentially half of Libya, and so Hitler feels like he has to bail out Mussolini by sending down a force of three or four divisions. Oh, and okay. Rommel is put in command of that. And here's really where he shines. And this really isn't a myth. I mean, he does a pretty amazing job with a relatively small force. He's very aggressive. He doesn't really wait until all his forces arrive. He counterattacks the British. And part of the problem here is the nature of the North African campaigns, that if you have a big success and you drive the enemy way back, then the enemy's supply lines got short and yours got long.
Oh, right, right.
And so so any advance makes you ripe for counterattack, basically. Mm. So Rommel counterattacks, and he drives the British basically all the way back to Egypt in spring and summer of 1941. He doesn't manage to capture the port city of Tobruk. There is so very quickly he becomes, and I thought this was interesting because you don't see this with a lot of generals, but he became the object of propaganda on both sides.
Oh, as early as this?
As early as this.
From the Allies.
But,
okay.
By the time you get to the summer of 1941 and thereafter, it just grows and grows and grows. On the German side, there are a couple pieces to this. Part of this is sort of the what I will call the romance of Africa.
Yeah, yeah.
Africa was extremely exotic for Germans. And the idea that, I mean, go online and look at the emblem of the Deutsche Afrika Corps. It's a palm tree with a swastika on it.
Well, there you go.
Which is pretty much says it all. You know, for Germans,
Nazis on holiday. Yeah.
You know, and they had like newsreel footage of Germans buying things from Arab traders, and it was very exotic, and so it was a really good story for the German home front. Especially in winter, when people are on the North German plain suffering from a Northern European winter, and then they see all this sort of sun and
bad news, or at least the Russian front thing isn't going so well.
Right,
at the same
time. And that's even more important. They really kick the Rommel propaganda into high gear late 1941, early 1942, when the German offensive in Russia has stalled, mm-hmm. and so now we need a shiny object. What do we say these days? Squirrel.
Yeah, squirrel. Yeah.
It's like, look at this campaign where Rommel is running circles around the British, which he was.
We're talking about
repeatedly.
World War II movies, and we're using a 21st century kids cartoon movie reference. But yeah, sure. Yeah.
Little anachronistic, do you think? Yeah. There's a relatively high-ranking official from Goebbels' Reichspropaganda Ministerium. Mm-hmm. The propaganda ministry, who is embedded in Rommel's staff.
Yeah.
With the approval of all affected parties. Goebbels is a huge promoter of the Rommel myth and the Rommel propaganda. He makes sure that Rommel gets put on covers of magazines, and I'm unaware of any other similar headquarters that has such a high ranking propaganda official embedded in the staff the way Rommel does in North Africa.
Right. Which presumably Rommel is happy with.
Oh yeah, very happy with. And you know, go online. There are a ton of photographs of Rommel in North Africa, and that's not a coincidence. You know, he's in his command half track. He's talking with his troops. He's looking at a map. He's pointing off in the distance.
And that swamps the achievements and the perception of the achievements of other German generals, because there aren't pictures of Heinz, whoever, you know, doing something in the Western Front.
Well, and keep in mind, you know, this is a time when the Germans have, I always forget, but 100 plus divisions in the big offensive in the Soviet Union, and Rommel has 3 or 4 German divisions. If you're back at the German high command, you think this is a sideshow, and you can make a good argument for that, and yet he's getting all the ink, he's getting all the press, and you're thinking, well, why? Well, he hasn't done anything that important, and I can understand that. Mm. I mean, if you look at German propaganda, you'd think this was the most important campaign in the war.
Right.
And it just isn't. I mean, obviously, like I mentioned last time, if you take Suez Canal and Cairo, that's a big deal.
That's a big deal.
No question, especially in summer 42 when the Germans are attacking in southern Russia and conceivably you have a big pincer movement on the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But still, other than that, it's generally, if you look at the forces engaged, it's kind of a sideshow. And that leads us to the British angle.
Right.
Because the British have an interest in inflating the North African campaign and, by implication, Rommel.
Okay, that was going to be my next question, because is this propaganda sort of influencing the British idea and later the Churchill idea of we've got this war has to be won through the peripheries first and then up through Europe?
That's part of it. So it's a justification of British strategy. But even I would say even more important is, keep in mind, by the time the United States enters the war, very quickly, and the Americans are always there to do this actively, if not passively, the balance within the alliance is shifting constantly away from the British and toward the Americans.
Okay, so this is early 42 we're talking about.
Right, early 42. Very quickly, it's clear to Roosevelt, it's clear to Churchill that the Americans hold all the cards. They're the much bigger power. They're providing not all the manpower, but most of the manpower. Yeah. They're providing the lion's share of the equipment. And the balance of political power in the alliance is shifting. And it's clear that the Americans are going to play the bigger role in winning the war against the Germans. So if you're British, you are trying to play up the British contribution.
Right, right.
And so then you're playing up the only place where the British are fighting the Germans on the ground, which is North Africa. Mm. Fine, right? Except that you keep losing.
Well, there's that.
And then that leads us to playing up the brilliance of Rommel, right? Because you don't want to admit that your generals are bad. You want to say that their generals are geniuses.
Okay, gotcha.
And that's where the British start contributing to the Rommel myth. And so there's a lot of coverage of Rommel by name in the British press. In fact, I think I saw at one point, if you look at the British press, you could find a reference to Rommel pretty much every single day.
Wow.
Which is impressive, because there's a lot of war news.
Yeah. But that's almost like buying into the...
Exactly right. And in fact, there are British officers who pretty quickly detect that we're going too far with this.
Yeah.
And someone like Claude Auchinleck, who is commander-in-chief of the British forces in the Middle East. At one point, he takes over the 8th Army personally, but he's in charge in the Middle East. And he's starting to detect an effect on the morale of his troops. In other words, Rommel has basically gotten into their heads. And they start to believe they can't win against him because he's such a super genius.
Eek.
And so I think it's late 41 already. Mm-hmm. I should check that date. Auchinleck actually issues a deliberate order that in dispatches and in sort of press releases, we need to stop saying Rommel and we need to start saying the Germans.
Oh, so even in military press dispatches, they're saying exactly. Rommel did this, right. Rommel
even for
did that.
Right, even for their own internal purposes.
Wow.
In other words, we are making him into an unbeatable sort of superhuman.
Wow.
And that doesn't help any of us, so we need to stop that. And I thought that was really interesting.
It's incredible how perceptive so many of these people are on the ground, who are presumably preoccupied with military
right,
effect,
exactly, right.
But they're also thinking about these myths.
Right, right. And thinking about things like information policy.
That's absolutely fascinating.
Yes. And so And like I said, I think this is relatively rare where both sides are sort of mutually fueling this guy's reputation.
Lordy.
Now, I mean, let's keep this in perspective. You cannot deny his very impressive achievements on the battlefield.
Yeah, sure.
I mean,
yeah,
he was very resourceful, very aggressive, very quick to take advantage of developments. For example, the famous use of the 88mm anti-aircraft gun as an anti-tank weapon, which was decisive in some battles. I think it's the Battle of Gazala, where he basically lures the British tanks toward this screen of 88mm guns, and the carnage is almost complete.
And these weren't initially designed
for
this
sort of purpose? No, these are relatively large caliber guns that were meant for shooting down airplanes. But it turns out you can sort of lower the barrel and put in anti-tank ammunition, and you can basically destroy any tank on the planet.
Holy cow.
Even late in the war.
Wow.
And, you know, the British were not that imaginative in their use of tanks in North Africa, even though they often had great superiority in numbers. Mm-hmm. And Rommel is very good at sort of running circles around them. And, you know, we could talk about this someday, but the Royal Army takes a real long time to weed out some of their career officers who just flat out weren't very good and rose in the army because of their, well, they were aristocrats, basically.
Seniority or, yeah.
Exactly.
But also the myth of the tank is a big idea that is a tank and it's impregnable. But in many ways, especially if Rommel's using this brand new tactic,
that's
it's
right.
a death
that's
trap.
Right. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And lots of British tank crews lose their lives. So in the summer of 1942, he launches another offensive, and he manages to take Tobruk.
Right, which is very key.
Very key. It was a key port. It had huge stockpiles of munitions and gasoline, which helped him to continue his offensive. It was a big defeat, because remember, the British have suffered defeat after defeat after defeat, like the fall of Singapore, things like the fall of Burma in early 42. Then in June of 42, they lose Tobruk, which had held out earlier under siege for like 9 months. And then it falls, 35,000 troops surrender. It's a pretty humiliating defeat. Churchill is really upset again about another loss. And this is what gets Rommel promoted to the rank of field marshal.
Right.
Once again, way ahead of schedule. Field marshal is a very rare rank in the German army. And he's given his field marshal's baton. Clearly, Hitler is delighted with his performance and, you know, very happy to continue to promote him even out of proportion of his achievements. Then late 1942, it finally collapses around him. He suffers his defeat at the hands of Bernard Montgomery at El Alamein, famous battle.
Right.
October, November 1942. Right. It's one of the, often considered one of the turning points of World War II. Late 42, early 43, all these things turn south for the Germans at the same time. They lose El Alamein, the Americans and the British land in French Northwest Africa in Operation Torch. There's the Stalingrad battle. All this starts to go bad at the same time. Rommel is forced to retreat. And this defeat at El Alamein, first of all, he wasn't even there at the beginning of the battle. He battled constant severe stomach problems and constantly had to go back to Germany for hospitalization.
Oh, wow.
So he's not even in command in North Africa when Montgomery attacks in October.
Very difficult to have to be a tank commander if you've got a dicky tummy, as Montgomery
yes, exactly.
would say.
You know, and they didn't have Pepto-Bismol and things like that. So he rushes back. But even if he had been there at first, he was going to lose. Montgomery had one of Montgomery's advantages is he can sort of hold Churchill at bay. He's very patient to retrain and re-equip and build up his forces until he has an overwhelming superiority, because he understands that the only way you're going to beat Rommel is just to bludgeon him.
Right.
And by this point, Rommel's own supply lines are under increasing attack and increasingly vulnerable. He's running out of tanks. He's running out of petrol. So his tanks are not as mobile anymore. So he was going to lose that battle anyway, I would say. He was just crushed. It was a battle of attrition that there's no way he could win. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is Hitler, as is Hitler's pattern by this point, issues yet another stand fast order. In other words, just hold tight, we'll beat them. Rommel disobeys him. Rommel says, no, I want to save my army. And so he pulls out and retreats, and Montgomery is extremely sluggish in pursuit and essentially lets Rommel get away.
Oh, okay. That's right.
I'm not a huge fan of Montgomery, but of course that's part of this too. Montgomery then gets a huge reputation after this, because he was the one who beat the super genius.
Right, right. And El Alamein is still talked about as the greatest victory.
Oh, yeah.
African.
Yeah. Right, absolutely. And so with the British, finally we have a general who has success on the battlefield, so we have to pump him up and make him super brilliant. even though I would argue he was kind of mediocre in some ways. No, I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but he, I think, is overrated. Anyway.
Well, but one of the things we're trying to show in the whole raison d'etre for the Institute is a lot, one of the raison d'etre is that, you know, a lot of people, especially military leaders, are overrated. In fact, a lot of underrated ones are overlooked.
Right, exactly. Right. The relationship between achievement and reputation is...
Yeah, not one-to-one.
Kind of sketchy, absolutely. So he retreats with his Panzer Armee Afrika, as it was called by that point. The Afrika Corps was... the Panzer Armee Afrika was only sort of half German. The other half was Italian, but it was all under Rommel's command. And that was actually a problem. He had very dicey relationship with the Italians. In fact, one of the criticisms leveled at him is he's constantly sort of working this complicated command structure to disobey orders.
Oh, that is a fascinating.
Yeah. So on the one hand, you could say that's part of his political skill, but on the other hand, it also rubs a lot of people the wrong way because
back in Berlin.
Right. Absolutely right.
Wow.
Yeah. He does not have a lot of fans back in Berlin because he does a lot of this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. He's very strong. So very strong-willed, you know, convinced that he always knows right. And so he disobeys orders and can sort of work the system so he can get away with it.
So this plus the propaganda thing, his own self-promotion must have driven other generals crazy.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yeah. Wow. And ultimately, this is going to come back to haunt him in some ways. But he retreats with his forces intact, what was left of it, to Tunisia. And keep in mind the geography, by this point, because of Operation Torch, Allied forces are converging on Rommel and the Germans and Italians in Tunisia, in the middle of North Africa, basically.
Yeah,
he does score at least one last victory at the Kasserine Pass, where the inexperienced Americans are sort of handed a pretty ugly defeat.
And is that's an American tank war?
General. I mean, it was several American units involved. And this is where the movie Patton starts out, by the way. Patton is taking over and comes in and sort of surveying the wreckage of this attack. Well, that attack was delivered courtesy Erwin Rommel. It's clear that the Germans are going to lose in Tunisia. It's just a matter of time. They lose in May 1943. And interestingly, Rommel is pulled out a few weeks in advance of the German collapse. To preserve his reputation. We want someone else to take the loss.
Oh, it's not because he claims he's got a dicky tummy again?
That's the official excuse. Like, he's pulled out for health reasons.
Right,
By this point, his reputation has a life of its own, and they can't afford to let him take the loss.
The reputation having a life of its own, that never happens.
Exactly. I know.
It's extremely rare. Yeah.
You know, and let's remember the North African defeat. You can argue that Hitler bought himself a little bit of time, but on the other hand, about a quarter of a million Axis troops surrendered in May 1943 in Tunis.
Quarter of a million,
half of them German.
Wow.
So, yeah, he bought himself some time, Hitler did, but you could also argue he just sent massive forces into Africa a day late and a dollar short, by the way. These forces certainly could have helped Rommel out a lot a year earlier. You inject them into North Africa only to surrender.
Wow.
Sort of like what the British did at the end of the campaign in Singapore, by the way.
Oh, right.
Sending troops just to surrender. That's bad management.
Yeah.
So then comes the sort of the last phase of his career, which is late 1943, early 1944.
And he's back in Europe, mainland.
Back on the mainland and given command of an army group in the West preparing for the Allied invasion, which they know is coming. They know Operation Overlord is going to happen at some point.
Right.
He's given command of an army group, which it's two armies, the 15th and the 7th armies in Normandy and the Pas-de-Calais opposite the... right on the English Channel. Mm-hmm. And he has to prepare the defenses for an Allied invasion. So he oversees the placement of millions of landmines and all these sort of anti-landing craft obstacles. There are lots of pictures of him doing that too, by the way.
All right.
And by the way,
we should remind the buzzkillers that's the logical place for the landing to happen. It's not as if the Germans were being like, oh, well, we'll just go to the obvious place. Landing in Normandy and leaving from where they left in Britain is extremely difficult. It's almost foolhardy when the channel is so short. So putting all their troops in one basket, so to speak, at the Pas-de-Calais is not necessarily right. crazy.
Well, and also they do try to defend areas, other areas.
Right.
They're just spread too thin.
Right, right.
They don't have enough. They don't have enough landmines. They don't have enough concrete bunkers. They don't have enough. You know. Metric tons of reinforced concrete. They don't have enough because they're trying to defend hundreds and hundreds of miles of coastline. Mm. There is also this strategic disagreement, which is going to help lead to the German defeat. Because the head of the overall command and the rest is von Rundstedt, who mm-hmm. is Rommel's superior, another field marshal, a very experienced. And they disagree about how to confront the Allied invasion. Rommel's belief is that you have to stop the invasion on the beach. Because if you allow them to get a foothold, their superiority in materiel and in numbers will mean ultimate defeat for you.
Okay.
Rundstedt's idea is you can't defend the beaches because once they land, then all your other forces are spread out.
Uh-huh.
But rather, what you should do is concentrate a mobile reserve, find out where they land, and then rush all your reserves to that point and drive it back into the sea.
Oh, let them land and then kill them on the land.
Right, and then okay. in other words, force them to show their hand, and then you swoop on that point with all your mobile forces that you have held back in reserve.
Okay. Both of these arguments are a perfectly legitimate
dispute. Rommel's view in this is informed by his experience in North Africa. He becomes very impressed by Allied air superiority.
Oh, okay, and that would negate the argument.
You can't move your mobile units around if the Allies have complete control of the air. And by the way, that's going to turn out to be true. One of the reasons the Germans lose in Normandy long term is that they can only move their forces at night or in bad weather. By the way, Rommel's going to find this out personally. What Allied command of the air means, because on July 17th, 1944, his command car driving around as it does a lot in daylight is identified by a British Spitfire. And it's badly shot up, and Rommel is almost killed. He's badly wounded.
Wow!
He suffers several gunshot wounds.
Any of them in the tummy?
he might have welcomed that. Yeah, but no, I don't know. I forget the exact nature of his wounds. I know that he's badly injured and has to go sent back to the hospital in Germany and has to spend several months convalescing. I believe it at his house, being sort of nursed by his wife. Mm-hmm. I think it's near Ulm, and it's in southern Germany.
Right, right, right.
And after July 17th, 1944, he is no longer sort of on the battlefield.
Well, at the very least, Buzzkillers, I think that what that allows Rommel to do is to get his personal grooming back in order. After all, he's in a tank for most of his military career. I can't imagine that there are no showers in tank.
And you're not going to be very well photographed if you've got that 5 o'clock shadow.
Yeah. So one thing that Rommel would have really benefited from was, of course, a membership with Harry's Razors, one of the new sponsors of this podcast and of the Institute in general. In fact, I wonder if Harry's would have drop shipped the razors to him in North Africa. Speaking of,
if they knew as much as he was going to be photographed, I'm sure they would have.
Dodging the Spitfires and little parachutes.
Can I finish shaving at least?
Well, of course, this didn't happen to Rommel in the early 40s, but it certainly happened to me last year, because it's easy for you to recommend Harry's shoe, because I've been a very satisfied customer for at least a couple of years. That's right. I've been using Harry's razors long before they finished their financial negotiations with the advertising department here and the bean counters. Why do we use Harry's here at the Institute? Well, of course, we're in the bunker, but we still need to look good. It's partly because we got sick to death paying those outrageous prices for big name razors at the drugstore. Sick to death at having to ask a clerk to open the lock case where the blades are. It's like Fort Knox or Hitler's bunker. And we were super sick to death at the Fort Knox prices we had to pay for new blades. Big ripoff razor companies have always made a small change in their blades, come out with the newest version, and raise their already high prices. Harry's is different. Not only does Harry's charge a fraction of what the ripoff razors company charge, the good folks at Harry's mail the razors right to you, a regular schedule you set up with your membership. The five-blade razors now include softer flex hinge for more comfortable glide, trimmer blades for hard-to-reach places, which I use all the time, lubricating strip, and textured handle for much more control when it's red. And the prices are still $2 per blade compared to the $4 or more that you pay at the drugstore. And of course, the $4 or more, and then you have to get that loser to come help you open the case and pull them out like it's some sort of precious jewel. But how does Harry's do this? They own the factory in Germany where they make the blades. Harry's can produce high-quality razors because they own the factory and they own it themselves, and they sell them online for half the price of those rip-off razors company. And more importantly, Harry's has a special offer for you buzzkillers out there. They'll send you their popular trial set for free when you go to harrys.com. The free trial set already comes with a razor, five-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. You just pay a minimal amount, $3 for shipping. Plus, just for my listeners, just for you buzzkillers, enter the code BUZZKILL at checkout, and you'll get their post-shave balm for free. The post-shave balm is great. I use it all the time. You'll look better, and your face will feel better all day, right? Let me repeat that. Go to harrys.com, H-A-R-R-Y-S.com. Enter the code BUZZKILLS, two Z's, two L's, at checkout, and you get a great razor, great blades, great shave cream, and the post-shave balm. Do it now, buzzkillers. Harrys.com. Code at checkout is BUZZKILL. Your subscription plan is customizable in terms of shipping frequency. You can cancel at any time. If you're in North Africa, they'll send extra special planes over to drop them to your battalion. Harrys.com, BUZZKILL at checkout, and enjoy a whole new world of better and more affordable shaves. Now, back to Erwin and his recovery in Berlin, but in his home.
Even if your supply lines are really overextended, yeah, they will get those blades to
absolutely,
you.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes. But, you know, they don't want to leave the buzzkillers hanging anywhere.
No, indeed.
So
3 days after Rommel is badly wounded in that air attack, there's this famous July 20th attempt on Hitler's life, mm-hmm, when the conspirators in the German army try to kill him with a bomb that doesn't kill him.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so Hitler survives that attack.
The buzzkiller shouldn't know that in the show rundown that Professor Nash prepared for us, the notes for this period of July 20th, 1944, A.H. go boom. Adolf Hitler go boom. Because, of course, we're trying to keep up with that kindergarten exactly, demographic.
Trying to reach everybody.
Anyway, sorry.
So, kids, Hitler survived. But importantly for our purposes is that Rommel was soon implicated in the plot by the Nazis. And this is going to lead to his death. But there's a big myth here, and that myth is that Rommel was involved in the bomb plot.
He was not,
by all the evidence that we've seen in recent years.
He was not.
The Nazis, keep in mind that Hitler and the SS, after the bomb plot, go very, very hard after conspirators and search high and low. And they will arrest and torture and even kill people who maybe are involved and maybe aren't. Mm-hmm. If there are rumors, if they're guessing you're involved, if you come under suspicion, that could mean your demise. They had some circumstantial evidence that maybe Rommel was involved. It's possible that he knew of the plot and didn't do anything about it, or that maybe he should have suspected the plot was is underway and he didn't do anything to stop it. But there's no evidence that he actually was actively involved in the conspiracy. There's no evidence that he approved of doing away with Adolf Hitler.
Oh, okay. So it's not just he wasn't necessarily involved in the bomb plot. He wasn't necessarily involved in trying to take Hitler from behind.
Correct.
So
correct.
Oh, well.
No, and I'll clarify his position in a minute, but people should know that Paris and the German under the German military occupation was a sort of hotbed of conspiratorial activity.
Okay.
Apart from Berlin, the German military command in Paris was riddled with conspirators, some very high-ranking people who were some of the leading conspirators, and they're going to pay with their lives. But so they, in other words, these are people who are spent a lot of time at the same headquarters where Rommel is.
Okay.
And the thing is, though, people like Hans Speidel, who is one of the leading conspirators, and he's Rommel's chief of staff, he quickly learns that the conspirators should only have a discussion of the plot when Rommel is gone.
Oh.
When Rommel's out on one of his inspection tours, for example.
That's a pretty clear indication.
Which would suggest they don't feel comfortable discussing the plot directly in his presence because they don't trust him entirely. I mean, that would suggest that he's, you know, not only not a conspirator, but they don't feel like they can, you know, and keep in mind, it's if you're recruiting for this conspiracy, you have to be very, very careful, right?
I mean,
if you sound out the wrong person and they go and rat you out, you could all die before the plot ever gets, you know, 5 feet. So no evidence that he was actively involved. But it's clear that he spent a lot of time with some of the people who were involved.
Okay,
and it's
okay.
also clear to the Nazis after this that he has been making defeatist utterances. Because after the collapse, after they fail to stop the Normandy invasion,
right.
Rommel quickly concludes, and rightly so, that it's only a matter of time, that we've basically lost the war.
Mm-hmm.
So he becomes, and he's not the only one at all to think this way. Lots of high-ranking Germans in the army think this, that we basically have to cut a deal with the Western allies. In other words, make a separate peace with the Americans and the British, and then all of us join forces to stop the Russians.
Oh, wow.
In other words, let's make this sort of Western anti-Bolshevik coalition. Now, of course, this anyone who
can imagine
thought
this would happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's they're pretty desperate. He believes, rightly, that if the war continues, Germany's going to be destroyed.
Right.
He's a German nationalist. He wants to avoid that at all costs. So split the difference, right? Side with one set of bad guys against the other bad guy. That word of that sort of thinking on Rommel's part gets back to Berlin.
Here's
where people around Hitler, including some people in the army, they start to realize that this is an opportunity to take Rommel down. Martin Bormann, who by this point is Hitler's head of his, the head of the Reich Chancellery and a very powerful person behind the scenes at this point, he apparently has a long-standing grudge against Rommel.
Which a lot of people must have had from his early
days. A lot of people
days.
Had, and he, unfortunately, he's in a position to act on it. And so Bormann starts feeding information to Hitler, basically pointing a finger at Rommel. And so this is where Hitler starts to, I mean, keep in mind, for a long time, Hitler was a big fan of Rommel's
and would defend
him against criticism. Now Hitler doesn't do that anymore. And so this sort of consensus around Hitler develops that Rommel has to go. The difficult thing is that Rommel is now this amazing, super genius, your best general, great war hero. He had been given the Knight's Cross. You know, the basic German medal is the Iron Cross. Apart from the Blue Max, it's the Iron Cross. But it has all these embellishments, like the Knight's Cross of the Iron Cross, and you can add swords and diamonds and oak leaf clusters, and I'm pretty sure Rommel had almost all of them, if not all of them.
Okay.
So he's much decorated. He's a great war hero. You can't put him on trial. That's really embarrassing. Super embarrassing to admit that your great general that you've relied on so heavily turns out he's anti-Hitler. So Hitler sends a couple of generals to Rommel's house where he's still recuperating, October 1944, and present him with a choice. You can commit suicide, and we'll give you sort of a hero's funeral.
Right.
And we won't touch your family.
Oh.
So in other words,
that must have been the key.
They basically go gangster on him. or if you refuse, we'll drag you before the Volksgerichtshof, which people should check out. This is the literal translation is people's court.
Yeah.
Very different connotation today.
Yeah. Although Rommel was obviously interested in imagery.
But this was Hitler's kangaroo court run by the infamous Roland Freisler. You can go online and see actually some of the footage from these trials where the judge, Roland Freisler, spends a lot of time basically screaming at the defendants who are there holding their pants up because they've been denied their belts.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's really bad. In any case, a humiliating show trial, which would involve Rommel's interrogation and execution. And by the way, it'd also persecute his family.
Yeah.
So for Rommel, the choice is clear. He takes the cyanide. Mid-October 1944, he kills himself with cyanide. And for once, Hitler's actually good for his word. He is given a warrior's funeral, right? With the big, you know, the gun carriage and the flag and the honor guard and all that stuff. The official announcement is he's died of his wounds.
Okay. And he had been,
And he had.
In the summer,
it's, right. It's entirely plausible. And they didn't mess with his family. In fact, his teenage son, Manfred, actually went on to become mayor of Stuttgart, I believe, many, many years later.
Oh, wow.
So that's the end of Erwin Rommel. He dies of suicide.
And I imagine the funeral itself must have sort of, embedded this myth permanently.
Oh, absolutely.
In the German
mind
and the Allied mind.
Right, absolutely. Right, because then, like anyone else who dies prematurely, you've got this sort of blank canvas that you can paint on, like what would have happened afterwards, that sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah.
So then the way is clear for the creation of a post-war Rommel myth. And you start to see this really once the Cold War starts in the late 40s and early 50s. where, and you see this in Asia as well, basically everyone has to do an about face. The bad guys of World War II become the good guys, right? The Germans and the Japanese now are now our allies.
Yeah.
The good guys of World War II, the Russians and the Chinese become the bad guys.
Right.
And that requires a huge amount of propaganda work in the West, in places like Britain and the United States. And you see this all over the place. You see it in movies, you see it in books, you see it in magazines. Mm-hmm. A belief that you have to work on people, right? The pro-Soviet movies of World War II become the anti-Soviet movies of the late 40s, early 50s. You know, I Married a Communist, movies like that.
That's right, yeah.
And Rommel is dragged into this partly because once the Cold War starts, and once there is this huge military imbalance in the middle of Europe where German power used to exist, we now have an Iron Curtain. And on the other side, Iron Curtain is a massive Red Army that we can't hope to match. Mm-hmm. So very quickly it becomes clear that to defend Western Europe, we have to rely on West German manpower.
Right.
We have to replace the Wehrmacht with what's called the Bundeswehr, which is what it's called today. It's the Federal Republic of Germany. It's army.
Their army, yeah.
And has to be built from Wehrmacht veterans.
Because after all, that's the only people with experience.
And it was a very effective fighting force. And you have to rely on these people. You have no choice. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Then that everyone agrees in Washington and London and in Bonn, everyone agrees that that requires, they wouldn't say this, but that essentially requires some myth-making.
It's amazing how quickly this has to happen.
Pretty much on a dime, this has to happen.
By the way, when you mentioned Bonn, we need to remind the buzzkillers that West German capital then was Bonn.
Yeah. That was always going to be Germany's capital when we were growing up.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
Now it's back in Berlin. But basically, to create a Bundeswehr from the ashes of the Wehrmacht, you need to have an honorable Wehrmacht. You have to distance the German army of World War II from Nazism and Hitler.
Oh, sounds like the making of another myth.
That is the making of another myth. And it turns out that a very good sort of focal point for this is Erwin Rommel.
Right. After all, he dies a hero.
He seems to have been involved in the plot to kill Hitler, right? He's a German nationalist, but not a Nazi. And so he becomes sort of the archetypal good German.
Right, right.
You know, and keep in mind that during World War II, pretty much all Germans were bad.
In Allied propaganda, and in
popular opinion in the West. But now we have to start making distinctions. And so what you do is you create this small group of quote unquote bad Germans, mm-hmm. Hitler and the SS, this small little group who hijacked this otherwise good country.
Right.
Now, of course, if you look at the history of Nazi Germany, we talked about this in Hitler episodes, it's a lot more complicated than that. And the ring of complicity is much broader than a lot of Germans want to admit.
Yeah, yeah.
But the key here is that the British and the Americans now have an interest in working with Germans, in working with Rommel's wife, in working with Hans Speidel and other Germans trying to build this post-war military. They all have the same interest in creating good Germans, quote-unquote good Germans like Rommel. And so people like the British military officer and historian Basil Littlehart, mm-hmm. and Desmond Young, who writes this book, Rommel, The Desert Fox, which is then turned into a movie called The Desert Fox with James Mason.
Yes, James Mason.
James Mason, the perfect.
Yes. You can't get more honorable than James Mason.
Exactly. and of course, in here you have British, you know, really big name British actors playing German officers. I mean, that right there.
And
in case I forget to mention it, you also see in America movies like The Young Lions, where Marlon Brando is playing a German officer.
Oh, that's right. Right.
And so that's all part of this picture. But some of these early books and movies come very close to hagiography.
Right.
Rommel is established as not at all pro-Nazi. They suggest or say that he's involved in the bomb plot. Mm-hmm. And in a way, Rommel's well chosen because mainly because of luck. It turns out Rommel didn't even have an opportunity to become, quote unquote, a bad German. If you look at the fact that the North African campaign, which is one of the big part of his career, takes place in the desert where there are very few people of any kind.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Or then he goes to France, France after pretty much all the Jews have been handed over to the Germans, for example, by the Vichy government, or rounded up and sent to Auschwitz already. Now, what that means is that Rommel doesn't really have an opportunity to be involved in a lot of the atrocities and the war crimes that a lot of his colleagues are involved in.
Right. So he's not there to round up people. He's not, because he's fighting in North Africa.
And, you know, if somehow North Africa had been densely populated and had a huge Jewish population, it did have a Jewish population, by the way.
Yeah.
And there were cases like in Tunisia where the SS did show up and tried to go after them because the Nazis gonna Nazi. Yeah. They can't help themselves, but there's every reason to believe that Rommel would have been complicit in those sorts of behind the front line atrocities.
Wow.
But he didn't have to be. And so that gives him relatively clean hands. And then very quickly, there's this, the movie in particular, The Desert Fox, helps right. establish North Africa as a quote unquote clean theater of war.
That's interesting.
Right. And that itself is interesting because even after World War II, you have a lot of people, especially in the public, who want to believe that war can be sort of this honorable, chivalrous, a fair fight between equally reputable foes.
Right. Army guys versus the army guys.
Right. And where there's not about ideology and there aren't any war crimes and you treat prisoners of war and wounded enemy with great respect. And especially because the British and the Germans, North Africa becomes sort of this ground on which Germans and British can reconcile in the post-war period.
Okay.
And so it's sort of almost like culturally.
Oh, all right.
Right. So it's like, well, how do we sort of mend the fences of World War II now that we are allies against the Russians? Well, we can – it's a similar thing what you see in America after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, like how do Northerners and Southerners reconcile?
Right.
And you play up things like Gettysburg and you have the myth of the lost cause and you have the idea that both sides – like, wow, that was so tragic. You know, what were we fighting for anyway?
It was
right?
a family
we're,
fight.
Right, a yeah. family feud, right? It's like Germans and British, we don't have anything innately against each other. What a tragedy it was. And you know, it's nice that we can celebrate things like North Africa where it was a fair fight and, you know, it was sort of clean. It wasn't. There's no such thing as a clean war. There are always sure. atrocities on all fronts. Everyone has dirty hands, really. I mean, they're dirty. There's dirty and super dirty.
Yeah.
But the idea that this is somehow this sort of pristine fighting environment, unlike the rest of World War II, really is a lot of nonsense. But that is a necessary myth after World War II to help create a legitimate post-Nazi German army.
Yeah. Okay. So it's not just, I mean, it is reconciliation in a way and era right. of good feelings.
That's or burying the hatchet.
Burying the hatchet away. But it's also because of this very practical need to create the Bundeswehr.
Exactly right.
That's absolutely right. fascinating. They're That's right. absolutely yes. fascinating.
And this is one of many cases where history is essentially politicized. Now, of course, at that time, it was very recent history.
Sure, yeah.
But this is right. This is the first cut of history. And in Rommel's case, it's very long lasting. You can still find all sorts of people who view him as a good German.
Yeah.
With
well,
clean
we bought all into, when we were young, we
yeah,
bought into
absolutely,
him.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely right. It even gets more interesting when in 1953, the Rommel papers are published.
Mm-hmm.
These are his personal papers edited by Basil Littlehart.
Yep. It's him again.
And this is interesting because these papers are very instrumental in helping establish Rommel's military reputation as sort of a brilliant battlefield commander.
Right.
And that was partly the point of this. And these papers were then relied very heavily on subsequent biographies of Rommel. So this has these papers have a huge sort of ripple effect down through the decades.
Oh, right.
So what's interesting is that people later looked at Basil Littlehart's papers
mm-hmm.
and other sources and found that Basil Littlehart was, shall we say, an interested party.
All right.
Because the context here is in the 1930s, in particular, Basil Littlehart was a leading proponent of armored warfare and
yes,
was very much trying to influence people like Erwin Rommel. And so when putting together the Rommel papers, Basil Littlehart actually convinces Rommel's widow to include memorable material in the papers that's favorable to Basil Littlehart.
Oh, so they knew each other.
They knew each other. The papers were sort of edited and published with the cooperation of Rommel's widow, who of course is interested in burnishing the reputation of her husband.
Exactly, yeah.
As other people in Germany are. And Basil Littlehart, turns out, is trying to burnish his own Basil Littlehart's reputation.
Wow.
And so so you get the impression from the papers, erroneously, that Rommel learned a lot of his tactics from Basil Littlehart, even though that's not apparently the case.
Wow.
So the layers of politicization of this history just keep appearing, right? You peel one back and then you find another.
Well, and historians like an going out of their way to create myths. I mean, yes. This is manipulative.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Not only of Mrs. Rommel, yes. Ms. Rommel, but it's manipulative of the readers for the next several decades.
Well, and you know, let's be fair. If I'm claiming essentially that no one has clean hands, that's true of historians too.
Well, exactly.
Right? And there are other cases of this where you have sort of interested parties or people making sources up or things like that. I mean, it's not routine.
Well, except for the ones here at the Institute, right? We don't want to have a mutiny on our hands.
Absolutely not. You can trust us.
Strike. Yeah.
In any case, subsequent biographies, including some relatively recent ones, continue to emphasize Rommel as sort of a depoliticized pure soldier.
Right.
You know, who just happened to be fighting for the wrong side.
Yep, then that's certainly the way it was in the 60s and 70s.
That's right. And once again, similar to someone like Robert E. Lee. In other words, you conveniently downplay or even forget or ignore the fact that he's fighting to preserve a separate country where you have 4.5 million people enslaved.
Right.
You leave that aside and just look at what an amazing general he is and look at how he continues to sort of school his opponents who are superior.
Yeah.
Very analogous, I think. And so then Rommel's held up and taught in all the war colleges and like, here's how you run a battle.
Right. And he's considered a gentleman.
Right. He's getting upright, he's chivalrous, right? He respects his enemy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you just completely sort of whitewash the cause for which he fought and whitewash the fact that the extent to which he was okay with that cause. That's really the important thing.
That's really the big myth, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
There's little or no evidence that he is an anti-Nazi.
Wow.
This should probably go on the bookshelf. Ralph Georg Reut, who's a German historian, wrote a great biography of Goebbels.
Yeah.
He has written a book about Rommel, and it's not a full-blown biography, but it's a book that sort of deals with some of these issues, including the myth-making. I think it came out in 2005. I'm sure you can hunt it down and post it.
It'll be the book.
He, I think, concludes very fairly. He basically says that Rommel was not a Nazi, and he was not an anti-Nazi. Right? Which, in other words, there's a third category in the middle there, which, as Reut argues, A, creates a great deal of ambiguity, and B, puts him in company with millions of Germans.
Right.
In other words, Germans who maybe wanted to paint themselves as anti-Nazi after the war, but weren't during the war or during the Hitler period. Mm-hmm. Like millions of Germans, Rommel essentially said, you know, we follow the Führer and we thought it was our duty. And that means, I mean, it doesn't mean he's a Nazi. It doesn't mean he's responsible for the deaths of 6 million Jews, but he's also on the team. And, you know, keep in mind, like, as I may have mentioned before, someone like Rommel only, you know, becomes quote unquote defeatist when it's clear that Germany is losing. He was happy to be Hitler's instrument on the battlefield and to win conquests and to expand the German empire with all that entailed and with all Rommel probably knew about.
Right. Right. It's very unlikely he's not knowing about the Holocaust and things like that.
Extremely unlikely. All the evidence points towards that.
This is really, really the big myth and misconception we're trying to bust here, is that it, not only is he not an anti-Nazi, he's in this middle period, and this middle group. And the middle group, no one ever talks about the middle group.
You know, and we can't rule out the possibility that he's deluded, right? I mean, all we know, maybe he's convinced himself that he's just fighting for Germany and that anything bad happens, that's not on him. But he wasn't stupid.
No.
You know, we have to assume that he knew what he was doing and knew all about the Germany and the leader he was fighting for and fighting really hard for. I mean, even when he's in France, he's trying to thwart that Allied invasion. So the Germany run by Hitler, the Germany that's ethnically cleansing Europe, so that Germany thrives. And so he has to own that.
Well, thank you so much, Professor. This has been eye-opening on not only at the basic level of some of these detailed myths, but eye-opening about Rommel in general and about the nature of the German population, German public opinion at the time. It's absolutely fascinating. So thanks again for
my pleasure
for enlightening us. And we should let Buzzkillers know, we also want to thank Epicast, our network, and especially Buzzy, our sound engineer and editor and producer of the show, because he does all the genius editing and makes it sound better than it probably does.
Makes me sound like I know what I'm talking about.
At least in terms of the technical ends. And also go to the website, Buzzkillers, www.professorbuzzkill.com. You can follow us on Twitter there, Facebook. And of course, as always, please support us on Patreon. It's not just Harry's razors that's helping out the show. It's you. So we'll talk to you next week.